This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 103, brought to you in association with Blue Motor Finance, Capital.com and Smart Pension. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Christian Fayes, CEO of LendInvest. Christian last appeared on the show way back in 2014. It's clearly taken me a long time to recover for him to be back on now. In that show, he laid out the ground for P2P, including some incisive angles, which, to be frank, took several years to emerge into regulatory consciousness. As Christian has now been in London for some 13 years, he's become rather sort of civilised and tamed, but let's hope that he hasn't lost that Aussie ability to cut through the crap and tell it like it is. Since 2014, LendInvest has grown big time, having done over £1.2 billion of deals and having staff of around 140 people. Their claim is that they are turning property finance into a more accessible asset class, providing fast finance for property professionals and access to investments in secured property loans. Access to the investments is via four routes. 1. Online investment platform. 2. LendInvest capital funds. 3. Listed bonds. 4. Institutional funding lines. Cure. Like many things, the jet engine springs to mind. What starts as a simple concept, simple in execution, ends up growing in complexity. We'll hear about those routes later in the show. But for now, as you all know what peer-to-peer is, as I'm sure almost all of you will have heard about LendInvest, let's dive in and find out about the truth about P2P and where it's going. Also, out of politeness, I won't mention the recent Aussie cricketing ball tampering scandal, but it was a disgrace. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Christian. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Mike. Your podcast has grown as well.
My podcast has grown. Yeah. Yes, indeed. Well, actually, and if we'd been doing this in January, so would my waist have grown. But I'm glad to say that since January, I'm something like 6 kilos lighter.
Disappearing.
Yeah, disappearing. Exactly. Anyway, the podcast is still going up. Indeed, and probably no doubt due to your seminal appearance in late 2014. Now, I was just blaming you for ruining my life while we were setting up the microphones, insofar as I happened across a tweet of yours in February, where you had tweeted out about Nicky Morgan and the Treasury Select Committee trying to enforce gender quotas, basically, in the boards of fintechs. And that led me down a large rabbit hole. And as I sort of ranted about in LFB 100, I end up detesting the racism of the anti-racists, the sexism of the anti-sexists. And interestingly, I had some very good feedback from some listeners who said that actually it rather made them rethink a lot of their views on stuff, which is that, you know, a mate of mine I've known for a long, long time said, who has always been sort of left-wingy, radically type, he said that he thought he was safe off being anti-racist and anti-sexist.
Yeah.
But hadn't actually realised that you can take a virtue and push it so far, it becomes a vice. It like flips over into the opposite. And the general feedback that I got about me was how brave I was talking about these issues, which
yeah,
I found a little bit
crazy.
Yeah, exactly. Because I grew up in what used to be a relatively free country where you could say what you think, and I'm allowed to say what I think, and you decide whether I'm talking crap or not, but it's for you to decide. So
yeah,
that was me just following through. But in the first place, you must have had some bravery, either that or sort of red mist.
Well, no, I mean, I think I've probably calmed down a little bit since that interaction. It's been a few months now. But I mean, I think that the aggravation I had was just the politicisation of this issue. And in that particular instance, really just a politician trying to bully people in a public way, which I think is just outrageous. You know, clearly more has to be done. A business like LendInvest, you know, we intersect with different sectors, you know, the property sector, financial services and technology, all of which are very male-dominated industries. And I think for us, yeah, I would like to have more women in our business. But the reality is we have sort of over 40%. And I think we've got a pretty good track record. In-house legal counsel, our CFO are both women, and they're some of the most senior people in the business. But who is a politician to tell me who I should hire? I mean, the reality is I want to hire the best people to come into this business. And that's what I should be able to continue to do without sort of the prospect of being told otherwise. I think that's just good business, you know, race, sexual orientation, whatever it may be. I mean, we've got a very wide group of people that work with us and 140 people here. And I think that politics has a role to play in society, but I don't think it should be telling us how or who we should be hiring.
No, indeed. And as I said, quite amount of length. I haven't come across any fintechs or any CEOs, even in private conversation after a few beers or anything, who aren't anything other than kind of modern 21st century London people in terms of not actually discriminate about race, religion, creed, sex, and all that kind of stuff. I can't think of any. And actually, the other day I was thinking, oh, because of all this sort of non-stop sort of things you get thrown in your face, I thought, oh, I wonder how many women I've had on the show, and I wonder how many sort of ethnic minorities or something like that. I really had to think, because it just doesn't... if I talk to a group of people...
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I might spot the Aussies, because you've got to be careful with them, but they're the only ones that I discriminate against anymore, actually. Which, funnily enough, you're allowed to, because there's no sort of anti-Aussieism. And why I was blaming you for ruining my life was that led me down a very deep rabbit hole. I followed for quite a while on Twitter a whole bunch of folks, about 100 in the end, who were sort of anti-PC in the various ways. In the end, I just ended up depressed and sort of waking up in the middle of the night with it sort of going around my head, because some of the crap that's going on, you know, literally the racism and the anti-racists is one example. Heritage England is a body that looks after all the old buildings in this country, which gets £88 million of taxpayers' money. They have paid apprenticeships, which are advertised for non-white people. I mean, that is racist, you know?
Yeah, absolute
madness. And also, as I went on to say, in terms of the gender stuff, I mean, 40% women seems to be very high, and no real work has been done around this. If you take out the fact that there are lots of stay-at-home mothers and very few stay-at-home fathers. So when my girls were at school, and I occasionally would take them there, there was one stay-at-home dad. The other ones were the host women. A couple of weeks ago, it was really hot, and Bridget and I took the Thursday off, and we went to Leeds Castle. They're all a bunch of mums.
Yeah.
So just in terms of the workforce, and that's before you get to individual human beings making their own career choice. And as I say, in Sweden, which has got the most sort of gender-equal society, they have far higher rates of gender undiversity, if you like, according to professions. They have 20 times as many nurses as male nurses over there, 20 times as many engineers as not. So, as you say, the sort of political interference is crazy, but quite a number of fintechs end up signing up to quotas, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's useful as a society for us to be focusing on these issues, and I think that is a good thing, and certainly we are. I think that it was more around just the politicisation of a personal, you know, a politician trying to take political gain out of this. I don't think they
gave a shit.
I'm not going to talk specifically about this person, but, you know, I think it's more just about getting a headline than actually getting anything done to substantively deal with the issue. And I think that is just disgraceful. If you think it's a real issue, then deal with it in a real and proper way. And I think that's an issue across politics, across the board, you know, and you talk of issues of racial discrimination, those sorts of things. I mean, politicians are too ready to use those emotive sort of issues to their advantage for political gain, as opposed to sort of perhaps trying to deal with the issues. And I think it's just a dangerous trend.
Absolutely. And it can lead to society fracturing. I mean, it's very similar to what we see in the States, which is that the Democrats have got this strategy of heavily playing to identity politics and emphasizing it because they get a large chunk of the minority vote. And there's a sort of huge sort of stereotyping going on. I mean, this whole women versus men. Sorry, hang on. You're saying that 3.5 billion people are like this and 3.5 billion are like that. You know, that in itself is kind of mad. And the same thing we've seen over here. We had the London Council elections, or a few more around the country yesterday. And before that, we saw this whole sort of identity politics and religionism weaponized. So there was, you know, massive push on the one hand about the anti-Semitic stuff in Labour, which I didn't read about it, but certainly it seems to be real and unfortunate, which has held them back in some seats. And vice versa, you know, a lot of pressing on about Islamophobia. In London, the ethnic British, I think, are now sort of 45%, so they're in a minority. So you've now got, one of the most cosmopolitan cities in the world.
Which is one of the greatest things about
Which is really good, and one of its strengths. And I think, you know, it's one of the genuine reasons that sort of fintech has taken off here and all that, because actually people aren't very racist, sexist, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But if politicians keep emphasising, as it were, or creating tribal divides, divisions in society, you know, the people united will never be defeated, but the people divided can be ruled over fairly easily.
Yeah. Very fintech.
Very fintech. Well, I don't know. I'm just astounded.
I think the immigration thing is something that definitely affects fintechs. And, you know, I think it's something that if we look at sort of the ability to hire people and bring people into the country to employ them, I think that's a real issue that affects fintech businesses. And it's something over the last couple of years I've been increasingly more aware of the issues around that. And most recently had a few visas rejected for people we've wanted to bring into the country to work for us. And I find that whole issue has become very politicised as well, and obviously Brexit and all the rest of it we saw. But the reality is it's very hard to hire skilled talent. You know, we're essentially a small business trying to compete with or take on big banking institutions. And I wouldn't be applying for a visa to bring someone into this country to work in this business if I could hire someone here to do that job. I mean, you've got to pay relocation and all these sort of additional costs, time lag and all the rest of it to get them here, and then to have the visa rejected. It feels like there's a lot of policies that have not really catered to the needs of business in many respects.
Yes, there's a number of things around that. I mean, about 60% of listeners to the podcast are not in the UK these days. And for their benefit, there's been a huge fiasco at the sort of Home Office here that's responsible for this kind of stuff. And the head Amber Rudd has stepped down, and huge outrage over the so-called Windrush generation, those people arriving from the Caribbean in the 1950s who've been here their whole lives, suddenly being turfed out because they couldn't prove they'd been here for like the last 60 years and been refused treatment. So absolute disgrace. And that was, you know, very sort of a big political fuss and all that. But also, you can't discuss, because of this political correctness stuff, you can't really have a sensible conversation in this country about immigration without being labelled as Nazi or, you know, racist or something like that. And as I was saying to you before, I've actually given up following all this anti-PC stuff now. I'm just doing my head in. The statistic that springs to my mind is that at the moment, the net immigration into the UK is around 200,000 to 300,000 per annum, which is quite a lot of people. The gross immigration, because people are obviously leaving the country as well, the gross immigration is around 600,000 people. So I believe those statistics are roughly true. So if that's the case, then the fact that businesses like yours are having difficulty, and I hear it all over the place, I mean, everybody's always recruiting and they're always finding it hard to get people, is not necessarily per se, if Parliament ever had a grown-up conversation about this, due to the gross numbers, but somehow due to the criteria. But anyway, that's politics for you. So how was the cricket anyway?
I don't really follow the cricket, actually. I find it funny with the English. They love talking about the cricket when they're winning. And otherwise, a non-topic. Apparently, everyone does it, so...
Yeah, well, exactly, yes. It's just the degree. Okay, so anyway, moving on from this sort of the global picture out there onto the far more fascinating topic of peer-to-peer.
Is it?
Well, this is the question, isn't it? Yeah. Where was it? Where is it? Where's it going? And do we really care? I was mentioning before that back in the day, when you were on about 4 years ago, peer-to-peer was, I was about to say, the great white hope. That's probably racist these days. The great rainbow-coloured hope. And, you know, it's going to just destroy banking overnight. Another such bullshit that, of course, was never going to happen. Given that banks create money, if you destroy banking, there is no money. You know, it's sometimes a bit rude to say, does anybody care anymore? Of course, they do. Lots of people are benefiting one way or another. But just an example, I mean, AltFi, the leading news source over here, they were called AltFi Alternative Finance. They've kind of broadened their brand a bit now and trying to do more fintech stuff. Lendit, the world's largest conferences, I think they're now branding themselves Lendit Fintech.
Yeah, they do, yeah.
It's like everyone's going, oh, okay, let's move on somewhere else, you know.
Yeah. And there's a BlockFin part, the last Lendit conference. Yeah, but does anyone care? I mean, I think peer-to-peer has had an interesting history, but it's been around for a long time now. I mean, even before I moved back here, I saw elements or sort of platforms that were kind of the early days of peer-to-peer in Australia for businesses that, you know, you now will never have heard of, that sort of have come and gone. And I think there was a period of time, if you go back 3, 4, 5 years ago, where peer-to-peer was synonymous with fintech. And so I think there was a lot of hype around fintech, and people were sort of very much, to be a fintech business, you need to be a peer-to-peer business. Where I feel now, peer-to-peer is just really a subset of that broader church of fintech and that movement. And I think a lot of the businesses are now going through a period of maturity and probably just more focused on trying to build a real business that's sustainable, as opposed to headline the next big event and sort of be on stage talking about the disruption of banking. I think the thesis back then was quite an interesting one, and there was a lot of VC money chasing it, that the banks have legacy technology, they're dealing with increased regulation post the crisis, and just sort of have legacy loan books that are kind of going to keep them distracted for many years. And so there's a real opportunity for fintech startups to come in and just eat their lunch. I think the reality is now you see it's actually not that easy to go and eat a bank's lunch. And also the banks are going to defend their turf. And some of them have been extremely successful with that. And I've just been in the US where you look at Marcus, the platform launched by Goldman Sachs. I mean, it's done phenomenally well.
How much has it done?
I think it did like $3 billion or something in its first year.
That's all right.
It's not bad. You know, I don't know how long it took Lending Club to do something like that, but I think there was definitely a perception that at the time that Goldman's probably coming really late to the party, but actually they've probably just watched a lot of others, learnt from certain mistakes that have been made and have executed superbly. And I think we see that with our business as well. I think 3 or 4 years ago, we thought the whole concept of a mortgage going online was extremely exciting. But now, actually, I think if anyone sits here and thinks in 5 years' time they're going to have a mortgage business and not have a strong online part to it, they just won't be in business. So I think in many respects, that excitement around finance going online and fintech and all this sort of stuff has sort of come around to reality, where fintech is just finance. I mean, I couldn't imagine starting a business in any sector today without having a website or without having sort of technology as a really core part of that business. So if you're starting a finance business today, it's a fintech business, because it's going to be very technology driven and technology is going to be a key part of that business. So I think that it's probably confusing a little bit, the sort of peer-to-peer and broader sort of fintech sector, but I think there's just a lot more reality has set across the sector now.
Yes, I'm sure that's true. And I think the other thing that was missed, omitted, or not understood by many people writing about it who had no background in FS at the time, as I've emphasised many times, was a misunderstanding of what a bank is. Banks have great advantages. They create money out of thin air, and they can also transform maturities. And so the more sophisticated argument was, for the sake of argument, let's say a bank is leveraged 10 times, so £1 a deposit comes in, they put out £10 of loans on the other side. So for the sake of argument, the question was not that peer-to-peers would be more efficient than banks, they are, but would they be more than 10 times efficient, for the sake of argument? If they were more than 10 times efficient at transforming input into output, then they could dominate banks, but we assume that isn't the case. So one of the angles that I rather liked in the autumn of 2014 was that you were differentiating, even at that time, into the various models. I mean, if we didn't use peer-to-peer,
yeah,
but grouped people together, we had different ones. We had, for example, Funding Circle doing kind of one thing and RateSetter doing kind of one thing and you guys doing another thing. And then the regulators come along in the meantime and I've frankly lost track of which regulation you're all under and all that kind of stuff, but some of you are under different regulations. So just in terms of a taxonomy, maybe we can start with a regulatory thing. What are the regulatory buckets that the general public might think of as a peer-to-peer are actually in?
Yes.
Then forgetting the regulatory buckets, what kind of are the different models?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, I think it's become quite complex. And I think one of the sort of things that's been flushed out through the FCA putting in place a regulatory regime, or the government putting in place, and the FCA sort of doing their reviews of the industry, is that when you look at all the different online lending platforms that are out there, there's none two were the same. And so everyone sort of had different quirks, whether it was sort of provision funds or, you know, secured lending platforms, or in our instance, sort of pre-funding loans and then sort of selling down loans to investors online. Very different sort of regulatory setup. So from LendInvest's perspective, we're actually not a peer-to-peer platform.
That's what I thought, yeah.
Yeah, so...
Just so you're here under false pretenses.
No,
I'll go home,
not
man.
At all. I mean, I think actually we think we've come up with a better model.
So what are you called then?
We call ourselves an online investment platform. And that online investment platform is just one of the various channels of funding that we have that investors can sort of get exposure to our loans. And when an investor invests in our loan, they essentially are investing in a fund. But the fund is directly related to an underlying borrower and property. And we've just come up with a systemized way of issuing many funds. I think we're probably the biggest fund issuer in the country. And we know that by the sequential ordering of the FCA numbers that come back from, you know, every time we issue a loan and put it on the platform, it technically is a new fund. And we think that's just a better regulatory structure for investors. There's certain protections around the fund structure. It's commonly understood by investors. For us, we're not a retail-focused platform. And I think we've been on a bit of a journey with our platform, which I think has been... There's been a lot of interesting learnings from that. We, you know, you see the tube ads and stuff around our offices here that we ran for a period of time. And
the only thing I saw was get shit done on a poster in another room, actually.
We've got their new posters. Let's make sure we remember. Yeah, we did a lot of mainstream advertising, and I think we learned that you can spend a lot of money to acquire a lot of retail investors, but it doesn't make a lot of commercial sense.
No. What you need to do is sponsor podcasts. I'm told that's the thing to do.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think if you've got a sophisticated audience and that's who you're going after, which we are now, then that is a better route to be looking for investors than perhaps TV ads. But that's just a call that we've made. We didn't think it made sense commercially. And also we're just concerned from a regulatory perspective that if or when things come unstuck, the regulator will be much more concerned about platforms that have been heavily targeted towards retail investors. And, you know, I saw it. An investor that comes on and puts their debit card in and invests £100, when I look through the range of questions that profile of investor has, I just don't think they properly understand. Well, there's a good argument to be made that they perhaps don't understand what they're doing. Is it a bank account? Are they investing in property? Is it sort of, you know, who knows what, you know, what they actually think it is? And so I think for us, we just made the decision to target sophisticated and high net worth investors, but then we listed a retail bond on the stock exchange. So that's a very, very regulated structure, right, and investors can invest in
Okay, so we'll come back to the LendInvest different types of products later, because I think that is of interest. So going back to the regulatory categories, you're not actually a peer-to-peer, you're an online...
Online investment platform.
So that's one subspecies of what people might generally think of as P2P. Another subspecies from a regulatory perspective is...
Is the more pure peer-to-peer platform. So you have a direct contractual link from a regulatory perspective between the borrower and the investor.
Say Funding Circle.
Like a Funding Circle, Zopa, RateSetter.
RateSetter's a bit of a fund though, isn't it?
Well, again, it's been a long time since I've looked at this in deep levels. So basically you've got the peer-to-peer model, and I think on a sort of a business model side of things, the peer-to-peers generally fit in this sort of pure marketplace proposition where they don't take any balance sheet risk. and it's a very capital-light model, and I think that they draw analogies to it being an Uber or an Airbnb-type business model where there's huge value in being able to do a lot of lending and actually not actually have any capital set aside for that. For us, we do a lot of off-balance sheet lending, but we're also happy to have skin in the game. So for us, we do have equity provisioned against our loans, and all of our loans that go onto our online platform for investors, we fund in the first instance. So there's many instances where a loan just doesn't sell to investors, and we hold that loan, and we're very happy to hold it.
Which is a huge deal, isn't it? I mean, if you're going to flog me something on your platform,
yeah,
it's a huge deal to me that you bought it in the first place, and if I don't buy it, you're going to be holding
it. Just hold it.
That's
yeah.
massively different from somebody who's sort of putting something on their market stall and they're never going to eat those apples.
Yeah, it is different. I think from an investor's perspective, it's a better model. But obviously from an enterprise value perspective, people say, well, you can often have a lot of capital tied up in loans that perhaps don't sell. So it's maybe a less valuable business model. We think it's a more sustainable long-term business model. But everyone's kind of picking their path and each has its advantages. I think that for us, it's been easier to scale having some skin in the game. For getting institutional investors, yeah. if we provision equity against every loan that we do with that institution, then they're able to give us funding cheaper. And the reality is, I think hybrid models like ourselves have been far more profitable than the pure peer-to-peer platform.
Interesting. So why is that then?
Well, because it's originate to distribute in terms of their business model. So you've got to reach huge scale to be able to, you know, make that pay off. And there'll be some that will do that. And I guess some believe it's kind of a winner-takes-all proposition where if you can have a dominant enough position where you can own a certain lending vertical, then that will be something that will be extremely valuable. But I think you've got to reach huge scale. And I think there's less equity investors around to stick around for that journey. And for us, we'd prefer to be as profitable business and stick around on our own terms than not.
So we've just got these two main categories then?
They're the two that I see in terms of the online lending space. Yeah. Then you have sort of just total balance sheet lenders, say like the Awakas of the world, yeah. which are providing a really good consumer borrower experience, but there's less of a sort of investor platform. They have sort of institutional investors that back the loans that they write. And I guess that's sort of coming down to what the core proposition is around peer-to-peer.
Yes. What is peer-to-peer for in 2018? What kind of problems is it solving?
So I think the problems it's solving are probably the problems it's always been trying to solve is to, on the borrower side, to have an online convenient experience and to be able to get a loan using an app or an online proposition. I think different lending verticals, that is more exciting than in others. So I think in the unsecured consumer space, I mean, when I open my Barclays app, they're always trying to give me a loan. Yeah, so I think the banks have caught up pretty quickly there and it's become hugely competitive. And that's before you have Goldman Sachs and Marcus and all those guys come in and just like wipe the market here in the UK. To like mortgages in our space where it's still very early days and actually there's no real online mortgage lender other than us, we would say.
And what length of mortgage do you do?
We do from 1 month now to 30 years.
Oh, right.
So it's a much more mainstream product, yeah. But it's only for buy-to-let investors, yeah. so you can't live in the property yet. So that's sort of for future years. And then on the investor side, I think it was peer-to-peer was trying to allow investors to have the opportunity to lend to people, which I think from a social element, that was quite interesting. And also to earn a return post the crisis. Everyone's looking for a bit of yield. But then again, on the unsecured consumer side, which I increasingly think is just not that interesting, do I take a 3% return or do I just take a term deposit in a bank? I mean, I think it's really, really marginal. On our side, on short-term mortgages, you can still get a 5, 6% return, which I think is pretty good. The SME returns are pretty good as data gets better and the sort of lending quality gets more sound. So I think it depends on the lending vertical, but I think that it has been shifting sands.
So the margin compression that's been taking place, coming back to your point about someone with £100 to invest, means that it's a much more nuanced decision requiring more personal research for, let's say, me or my mum to decide to stick £100 through you guys or Zopa or RateSetter or Funding Circle.
Yeah.
You know, a few years ago, my mates in the city would say, well, what do you think? I said, well, I don't know. But I said, you know, with rates like this, if you stick to the top blue chip platforms, you're pretty likely to make more money than you would do in a bank account as long as it's diversified.
Sure.
So that was a fairly straightforward thing requiring not much analysis. If a mate came to me now and said, oh, I'm just retiring tomorrow, I've got a bunch of cash, what should I do with it? I'd say, well,
put it with LendInvest.
Yes, I guess put it with LendInvest.
Not all of it.
But I wouldn't give him a slam dunk kind of, oh, yeah, sure, it's fine. It's kind of, well, actually, I'd spend a little while looking into it in detail, because if you're retiring, you'll have the time to.
Yeah. Well, I think these differing business models have continued to differ. And I think it's not easy for investors that are looking at this regularly to understand what the nuanced differences are. And I think if you look at the people that are retiring with a big wad of cash, but people that are just sort of trying to put small amounts of money to work, I think financial literacy, not just across the country, just generally is a real issue. And I just think it's very difficult for people to decipher is this a bank account? Is this a fund? Is this peer-to-peer? What is peer-to-peer? And yes. I think that's just something that will take a lot of time. And I think a lot of honesty from the platforms to be very transparent and make appropriate disclosures about what it is and what the risks are. You know, this capital at risk thing. If I go over to Sainsbury's and say, what does capital at risk mean? I mean, a lot of people probably won't even understand what that means.
No.
So I think taglines like that kind of are a nice start, but I think we've got to do a lot more.
Yes, in a way, I think diversity is potentially a weakness, because if Funding Circle is doing one thing and Zupa is doing another and slightly becoming a bank, and then RateSetter has got a sort of a more de facto funded kind of stuff, and you're on, I don't know, let's say Revolut, which has been the sort of, we must talk about the neobanks, has been the fastest sort of partner up left, right and centre. You're on your app. Oh, I see you've got 150 quid going spare, Christian. You know, do you want to bung it with so-and-so?
Yeah.
I mean, going back to wearing my professional risk hat when I was running a global empire, if the bank back in the day wanted to put serious money into these things, I'd have to get people researching this for quite a while before I give the chairman a recommendation, you know? And question, given how different these models are, whether when you're flicking through with your thumb on the train, knowing what you can do with your 100 quid, you couldn't possibly, and I agree with you with literacy, but the nuance of this is quite significant.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, I mean, RateSetter, last time Ridian was on the show, he was talking about or preempting how they were going to change their provision fund policy and all this kind of stuff, and, you know, and hard fail and soft fail. And I have to sort of concentrate sometimes to listen to that stuff myself with 30 years in finance.
Yeah, I mean, you know what you're doing. Yeah.
Yeah, but my mum would have no bloody chance.
Yeah. And the business models have become arguably more complex as well.
Yes, so it requires more research time.
Regulation is interesting because it made everyone sort of focus on what it is their business model is, and that has forced sort of probably some sensible changes in different business models. As opposed to where you go to the US, though, you know, where you look at every state's different and you don't really have buy-in from the SEC, I think, in the same way you do from the regulator here. I think a lot of positive things have been done. It's just, it'll take time.
So I mentioned the neobanks, the app-only bank and so forth, and obviously sort of Zopra is becoming a bank alongside, or whatever their sort of framing of it is these days, alongside being a peer-to-peer, which isn't selling out. So in terms of where the market's going, and you referred to sort of fintech before, and you know, maybe we could drop the fintech word someday, maybe we could drop the peer-to-peer thing, and as you say, it's just kind of finance really after a while, because everybody's using the same kind of mechanisms. Where do you see all of this kind of ecosystem, where do you see this kind of going in the future then? You've got all your peer-to-peers, they're getting more complex, they're going slightly in different ways. We've had the initial sort of exponential increase, and now it's sort of flattening off a little bit, and I question whether a lot of these platforms can hit the super mainstream in terms of, you know, having, for the sake of argument, 25% penetration of UK households or something like that. Where's it all going to go?
I don't know. I mean, I have sort of firm views on some of that stuff, and I'm no doubt wrong on a lot of it. But I think that a lot of the startup banks, again, were exciting 3 or 4 years ago, when perhaps the apps of the mainstream banks were a little bit awkward or clunky or didn't quite work. There's no doubt that Monzo and Revolut and so on provide a better experience. But is it a better experience where I'm going to actually make it my primary bank account? I don't know. The reality is, you know, I bank with Barclays and I don't like the bank, you know, and you know, it's a big mainstream bank, it's very clunky and all the rest of it. But the reality is the consumer experience is okay. Like the app receives money and I can send money to people.
Exactly. And you get your water from some huge semi-monopoly provider, you get electricity from some semi-monopoly provider, you get your gas from some provider, you get your finance from some big provider. So.
Yeah, it's just a pipe and the app works. So I think the excitement around a startup app now with a fancy coloured card and all the rest of it, like, yeah. It's interesting, because I watch the young people in the office here, they love it, and, you know, they're quite excited, and there's definitely a movement behind it. And like I say, the experience is definitely good. I think the technology is impressive, but I think there's kind of a cap. My personal view is just how commercially big those can be in some instances. And, you know, I think they end up just getting bought by a bank, and that puts a cap on the valuation because a bank's only going to pay a certain amount to have an app.
Well, it's customer acquisition.
It's customer acquisition. And some of them are hugely successful at that as well. I mean, you talk about Revolut. I mean, Revolut's kind of the outlier. And, you know, what Nicolai's doing there is seriously impressive, and it's kind of the next generation fintech in many respects. And when I look at those numbers, it's like everyone just shakes their head, and the way they've been able to deliver and iterate their product.
It's certainly on warp drive. Last week's episode was with Ricky Knox at Tandem Bank,
right?
Who you know, and he was talking about how he sees all this going. And you know, I was saying at the end, well, I think a bunch of them aren't just going to be a customer acquisition vehicle for big banks. And Revolut, I would like to say, will become the Amazon of the industry or the Chernobyl, and nothing in between. And what Ricky was saying, I guess it's sort of bleeding obvious, but I hadn't noticed it, and they've been growing immensely rapidly, was what they're particularly good at around there in terms of development process is that he has parallel teams doing all these different things.
Right.
So when Revolut turns out this, that and the other, yeah. And everyone outside going, oh my God, how can you do all that at the same time? Well, the answer is that desk over there is doing this, peer-to-peer alliances for your cash. That one over there is doing insure your mobile phone. And
yeah.
He seems to have a very good business model as well as making people work about 25 hours a day.
Yeah, which he's been in the press about. I guess that's what it takes to do that. I mean, I think for us, in terms of when you talk about some of the platforms becoming banks, I mean, for us, that's just giving up.
I agree entirely. I'm glad you said that. You're the first person I met who said that.
Well, it's just my honest view.
They've done it since 2005. You know, I say this to Giles, and you know, of course he has his own opinion, but I said, mate, you've been doing it for 13 years. If it was going to work, if you're going to sort of smash HSBC out of the park, you'd have done it by now. Okay, I'll give you the first 5 years for free because nobody heard of you or the whole industry. But, you know, it hasn't really been growing that much. And I do think it's a sign of defeatism.
It's probably a good decision, though. I mean, I think they will become a profitable business.
Exactly. They need to be sustainable.
They're probably doing that. But, you know, you're going to raise a huge amount of equity, you get the dilution, and then you've got sort of a huge amount of compliance and regulatory people telling you what you can't do with your business. So
this is the thing in favour of Monzo. They are actually a bank. Nikolai is not yet a bank.
Not yet.
In terms of how hard can it be to be a bank, I can tell you it's harder than it might be.
Yeah. But look, Monzo, you know, they're building really interesting tech, and I think there probably will be some breakout stars, but I don't think in 5 years' time we'll be sitting here going, oh, wow, there's like these amazing startup banks that are challenging HSBC. And I think the regulator realises that. I think that, you know, the Bank of England was sort of welcoming new banks with open arms a few years ago. I mean, we've seen people get rejected in recent times, and I don't think they're that excited about it because they haven't really created systemic diversification of competition. You know, great customer acquisition vehicles, but Barclays has, what, 25 million customers?
That's quite a lot.
That's a lot. They've been around for a long time. They've got a lot of data, and when they get their act together, they're going to be pretty good.
And also, I mentioned water, electricity, gas, and mobile phones and these things. I mean, in the modern world, everything tends towards oligopoly for a whole bunch of reasons across completely different industry sectors. So, you know, you can see the same thing rather than having 100 banks. Okay, so before we talk a little bit more about Lendivest and you updating us on your product set and where you're going, what do you think the future is, Christian? If I'm back here in 4 years' time, will you and the rest of the industry have gone from sort of saying, oh, you know, we've done a billion or 2 billion or 3 billion or whatever, that kind of number, to we've done 10, we've done 20, we've done 30, or will you be saying, oh, we've done 2? I'll say, oh, that's nice. And then I come back 4 years later, you've done 3. Let's talk about the industry as a whole.
Yeah, sure.
UK aggregate peer-to-peer loan volumes. I mean, is the growth slowed down now? Or are they going to suddenly take off?
I think in 4 years' time, there will be a number of players that will be mainstream names in financial services, and certainly we hope to be one of them. They will have reached a launch trajectory which is meaningful in the system, and I'm not talking just about peer-to-peer, but you know, some of the, all the names we've sort of talked about today, and I think that that will be really interesting. I also think there will be a massive graveyard of companies that just don't really ever get to profitability and sort of run out of investors.
The fintech bubble, dot-com bubble.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know if it'll be as extreme as that because I think some businesses will get bought out with others and some are creating technology, which is interesting, and there'll be some consolidation, but there will be some breakout stars, I think.
Right, okay. Well, I should be polite and I won't mention the fact that I noticed that you didn't come up with any number forecasts. I've said in the past, actually, that a great tip when I was a fund manager, I remember reading that if you give a forecast, you either give a date or a level, but never both at the same time.
Well, 4 years out, I know I'm going to be wrong. So. And now we've got our listed bond. I'm always reminded that I need to be careful with what I say about the future in terms of specific numbers. But I think, yeah, I mean, we'll be doing multiple billions a year, that's for sure.
Good. Okay, so before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there, going back to where I started. I hope most of you are in countries with more sensible propositions. And the politicians, as well as propositions, we've got very sensible propositions here in FinTech. I'd also like to thank my brand partners of the podcast, Blue Motor Finance, who are, according to the 2018 FT1000, the fastest growing FS business in Europe. Blue's award-winning technology has supported over $1 billion of lending, working with over 3,700 UK motor retailers. Capital.com, making CFD trading more accessible and engaging in 23 languages, 500,000 downloads in 51 countries. Check out capital.com or download their app. Trading is risky. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. So probably an easier topic for you, Christian, is to tell me all about LendInvest. So if I'm a property person and I want to borrow money...
Well, it depends what you want. So on the borrower side, we've positioned the business at the moment as really a one-stop shop for property entrepreneurs. So there's three core products that we've got. Short-term bridging finance, which is where the heritage of the business, where it's our sort of dominant product. So if you're an auction purchase or you just need quick capital, you know, the average mortgage in the UK takes 3 months. We can lend on average within 14 days, so we can give you the capital to make the acquisition. We do development finance now, so we do ground up. If you're building a house in the regions or, you know, there's sort of a more intensive build, we can provide development finance. And we also now have a buy-to-let product. So if you're a portfolio landlord, and the products are a complementary product suite. So if you're a developer, you buy a block of land, you build a couple of flats, you want to hold them as buy-to-let, we can product switch you very easily. So we're a very attractive proposition because you can transition through the life of the project.
And we should probably have said earlier, and it's a good point now, in terms of what peer-to-peer is up to, one way of segmenting it is by the subsector of the market. I mean, you've mentioned, you know, retail, consumer, unsecured borrowing, but, you know, one of the things I quite like about you guys is that you have the word property.
It's secured, yeah.
Secured, yeah, exactly. That's what you're aiming at. Okay, it's nice and simple.
Yeah, I mean, some of that stuff we just sort of take for granted, but yeah, I think it is a point. And you come back to sort of talking about investors, whether they can properly differentiate what they're investing in.
Well,
I think the fact that it's secured with plenty of equity headroom from the borrower against an asset that can be sold pretty easily is pretty compelling. And through the cycle, that will show to be a superior sort of proposition.
Okay, so that's how you help out people who want some dough. People who've got some dough, you said you don't do retail these days.
Well, we've got four channels.
Yeah, so explain those, because I got very confused.
Sort of where the business started was as a fund manager. So we have a fund that we manage out of Luxembourg, which is sort of small institutional investors, family offices, offshore typically. So all over the globe. Then we have our online investment platform, which is for sophisticated investors, UK-based.
So that's me ruled out.
Well, there's a little test you've got to do now.
I wouldn't get through that, mate.
I'm sure you'd pass. Where you can select the loans and sort of curate your own portfolio. Then we have just mainstream institutional funding lines from Citibank and a number of banks where we, you know, we have equity, skin in the game, and that has been where the business has scaled. Into a 30-year product. So a 30-year mortgage that we're able to give to borrowers at 3%, wow. That's not something that an online investor wants to invest in, but a big bank is very happy to take that. And then finally, we have our retail bond program.
Which, so what is this listed bond thing then? Explain that a little bit. We haven't touched on this.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So we listed a retail bond program on the London Stock Exchange last year. It was interesting going through the roadshow of doing that because a lot of people are not that familiar with the retail bond market.
Of course, I'm completely familiar, but I should just pretend that I'm not and have
explained. No, well, yeah, I mean, I when the guys came to me and said, let's do a retail bond, I was like,
what's one of them?
I'd heard of that.
Like, yes, of course, I know that.
But what exactly is that? So basically, it's a regulatory way to list a bond on the stock exchange without being a big corporate. It's predominantly big corporates that do it. There aren't any fintechs that have done it previously. Typically, listed companies will list a bond as a way to raise capital. We're unlisted and we're a fintech, so it was quite an interesting project for us to undertake, but we thought we didn't want to close the door to retail investors. We think the loans that we originate are a great investment.
So going back to simple things, it's listed on the UK Stock Exchange, so is it an equity?
It's not an equity, it's a bond, but you can buy it through
equity
brokers like Hargreaves Lansdown or your stockbroker.
So it's a bond, but you buy it through stockbrokers and you can sell it through stockbrokers and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
How big is it in terms of the money in it?
Yeah, so the program was £500 million.
Oh, right.
And we do it in
tranches.
Quite significant. That's the program is significant, but we only did £50 million when we launched it. Because the issue for us is cash drag. If we raised £500 million
and
that lands in the bank account day one, that takes a long time to put that out. Less time as time goes on. But so we did £50 million, we just did £40 million before Easter. I mean, it's a program that we can just roll out new tranches as
so it'll be the LendInvest, whatever it is, listed bond tranche A, the LendInvest was more tranche B.
The ticker is, well, this is not a financial promotion. Your capital's at risk. It's LIV1 was the first tranche, then it's LIV2. And it pays a fixed coupon of, well, the first one was 5.25%, and the second tranche was slightly more.
So the listed bonds are different tranches of the same program.
The same program. Same criteria of loan. It's a very plain vanilla proposition, and it's backed up by a guarantee from the parent.
And so what are the assets in them inside?
Very plain vanilla short-term residential bridging loans.
And what's the maturity of the bond?
5 years.
Right, okay. Amortizing, presumably.
No, 5-year bullet payment at the end.
Oh, okay. I see. So when you create it, you get 50 million
yep.
of cash and you stick it into this vehicle called a listed bond tranche B or
yes.
whatever.
Yep.
And then for the sake of argument, somebody sits out there basically a bit like a sort of a fund manager and spends some of the money on some assets,
yep.
which are then kept in this bond.
A bit different, yeah, but yes. yeah.
Schematically speaking.
Yes.
And then if one of those sort of repays early or something
so
like that.
So we just keep rotating it into
the guy slash girl.
Yeah.
Or slash other agendas, goes and buys something else inside the bond, just like a traditional fund manager in the way.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. It's just a pool of money that we put to work against a criteria of loan, which is predefined, and it's our job to put it to work. And then in 5 years' time, we pay it back.
It's pretty much almost exactly like what I did 30-odd years ago when I was a fixed interest fund manager and I ran a mutual fund, other than it's a different kind of wrapper and you're buying a different kind of...
Yeah, it's very similar to the large corporate bond market as well.
You take the headache away and there's obviously diversification within the fund.
Exactly. There's quarterly reporting. It gets audited. We just think it's a really good regulatory structure for retail investors.
Yes.
You know, if you don't really understand what's going on...
Well, that'd be much better thing to bung your 100 quid in rather than go onto your platform and go, I'll have one of them. I'd have thought.
I think it's a very...
I'm not giving any investment advice.
No, exactly. Neither am I, but I think it's a much more suitable retail product than a lot of other things out there.
Yes, and ask your investment advisor whose fees you can no longer afford or your stockbroker, whether that's a good idea or not, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, look, that's who you give money to and that's who you take money from and how you take it. In terms of where you guys are today, in terms of throwing bread crumbs upon the waters for the millions of listeners who will no doubt listen to this and set new records of listenership, what breadcrumbs do you want to lob on the waters?
What do we want?
Yeah, what do you want? More sex, more drugs and rock and roll?
Yeah, I've given up on that. I think we're trying to build a substantial financial services business that is technology driven. So I think we are always looking for skilled people that can bring deep expertise into the business. And I think it's really important for us to get a balance of people that come from deep financial services. I don't think you can disrupt financial services if you know nothing about financial services.
Yes, for a this start. Is one thing that's changed.
So I think, you know, we want to bring people in who know how the system works. And we want to really balance that with just really talented people that actually are, their DNA is to challenge things and to sort of question why things have been done a certain way. And are technology driven, data driven, and sort of used to or have experience in working in high growth business, because you know, we want to be high growth, not necessarily in terms of our headcount. I'd rather have no more than 200 people in this business, but be doing many billions a year, and to be doing it as efficiently as possible. And to do that, we need the best people. So if there's any good people out there that are interested in working in a really interesting business, definitely get in touch.
Okay, so any other things you'd like for Christmas or before?
Well, I think if you are one of those investors you talk about, your friend that's retiring and do have investment monies, consider us as a place to put some money. And you know, we've got a range of different channels of which you can invest in. And I think you'll find you get a pretty good return that will weather pretty well over time.
Good. Okay, well, thank you for that question. It's interesting, and it's very interesting thinking back to 2014 and how it's all come now, and I'll be very interested to see how it's going in 4 or 5 years' time. But I certainly have great respect in peer-to-peer for the sort of top 5 or 6 who remain pretty much the same top 5 or 6 for about 5 years now, who are very blue-chip firms, and I've given up being annoyed by PC and all that kind of stuff, I'm trying to give it up. But one of the things, actually, I find slightly peeving is that a lot of people, well, not a lot of people, actually, it's a tiny minority are complaining very vociferously, when actually it's almost the best possible world you can live in. That's what I tell my two daughters. I mean, okay, yes, there is some sexism left, et cetera, et cetera. But I've got to tell you, girls, you didn't want to live 50, 100, 500, 1,000 years ago. It's a wonderful world to be living in London. It's a very liberal place. It's very tolerant. Don't believe all the propaganda and all that kind of stuff. And these really are interesting businesses to work in. When I came into the city in 85, having started in what wasn't called tech those days, but anyway, having started in tech, I worked at a Clonwell Benson, the blue chip merchant bank, and one of the best things about it was that finance was changing, and that was a great vehicle to do it with a bunch of folks who had real integrity. And these days, I think that were I to be whatever I was then, 23, 22, I would want to join a firm like yours or the similar blue chip ones, because you're a really nice place to be. You've got positive culture and you're actually doing things and going somewhere, and it's been in my mind for a long time that this sort of future is bifurcating into kind of battery hen factories or free-range chickens. You're sort of a bit smarter free-range chickens than you used to be. So I wish you every success in the future, and I look forward to hearing in 4 years' time where you've got to by then.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory / non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight dance.